We take much for granted. We take for granted our health, our wealth, the freedoms we have within our land, the fact that we live in a country with a democratically elected government, in a land where there is free medical care, where there is a welfare system to provide when things get tough. We take for granted much of what we have. And yet the Bible warns us over and over, nothing lasts. Nothing lasts. Nothing lasts forever. So Isaiah chapter 40, verse 7, all men are like grass and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall. We all die. No one lasts forever. Things don't last. Treasure, says Jesus, Matthew 6, moths and rust will destroy. Nations and empires don't last. They come and they go, Ezekiel 28 and following. And yet, in spite of knowing this, we continually put our hope, our confidence in that which is not eternal. So we get ill, we face death, we look to doctors and medicine to rescue us, and we're crushed when they can't. We buy things and they break and we get disappointed. We put our hope in our nation, we shelter in it, as it were, and we expect it to provide peace and economic security and jobs and free healthcare and pensions, and we expect it for ourselves forever. We expect it for our children. We expect it for our great-grandchildren. And yet nothing lasts forever. And the truth is, as we look around at our nation, the things that we have taken for granted, our children won't be able to. And if not our children, then certainly our grandchildren won't. And in the quiet moments when we dare to think about it, as we ponder the state of our nation, and as we ponder where Western civilization will be, as we look out on the world, the fear wells up, the panic sets in. What will it be like for our children, our grandchildren? Will they know peace and prosperity? Because the nations that provided it will crumble. Nothing lasts. We hear in the news this week, North Korea threatening to send nuclear missiles at the US. Fear wells up at the very thought. But nothing lasts. And the Bible teaches us that in such a transient world where nations come and nations go, there is only one place of real hope and real security, and it's not in the nations. It's to be placing our hope in the one who is in charge of the nations. And Ezekiel chapter 31 makes it very clear that it is the Lord who is in charge, who rules over, who is sovereign over the nation, and he is the one in whom our hope should be. Because it's the Lord, firstly, who raises up the nations, verses 1 to 9. It's the Lord who raises up the nations. See, chapter 31 of Ezekiel sits in the midst of what is called the oracles against the nations, prophecies against the nations that surrounded Israel. And last time, when we were in Ezekiel a few weeks ago, we were looking at Ezekiel chapter 28, and Ezekiel spoke words against the king of Tyre. And we saw as well in that time that he'd also spoken previously against the kings of Ammon and Moab and Edom and Philistia. So they're in chapter 25. And each nation is judged for its wickedness towards Yahweh and in turn towards his people. And now, here in Ezekiel 31, the Lord speaks his words of judgment against Egypt. It's a nation that has so mistreated Israel for years. And the oracle, the prophecy, starts in chapter 29 and it concludes in chapter 32. And chapter 31 is a good summary of what takes place. But it's also a good summary in many ways of the oracles as a whole. Because what becomes apparent is that it is the Lord who is in charge of the nation. It's the Lord who raises up the nations. So you have a look with me, verse 1. In the 11th year, in the third month of the first day, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his hordes, that is his military might, his armies, his peoples, etc. Who can be compared with you in majesty? And Ezekiel seems not to allow the Pharaoh a chance to respond, but to propose his own comparison. And he says, Assyria. And Ezekiel is, what he's doing at this point is he's putting, as it were, his words in the mouth of Pharaoh. So we're supposed to imagine it's Pharaoh speaking back to God, who is compared to your majesty? And Pharaoh is effectively saying, consider Assyria. Consider the greatness of Assyria. That's who I want to be compared with. And verses 3 to 9 extol the greatness of Assyria and therefore by comparison Egypt in favorable terms. And there's no hint of guilt or wrong at all at this point. Ezekiel just lays out the magnificence of the nations as he puts these words on Pharaoh's lips, as Pharaoh kind of just extols the wonder of Assyria and therefore himself. So he says, look, verse 3, consider Assyria, once a cedar in Lebanon with beautiful branches overshadowing the forest. And within the Bible, it often draws the comparison of the nations with great trees. So you think of Daniel 4, you see it in Isaiah. These trees then become places of shelter and security. Here's a picture of the cedar of Lebanon, with a man sheltering easily under it. And when verse 3 speaks of the cedar of Lebanon as a big tree, they really were. And verse 3 says they have beautiful branches that overshadow the forest. And you can see that these trees towered high. And verse 4 makes it clear how it became so beautiful and so magnificent. It was watered by deep springs. Springs that flowed all around its base. And as it sucked up this spring water, kind of Evian water for trees, it just grew. And verse 5, it towered higher than all the trees of the field, and its boughs increased and its branches grew long, spreading because of abundant water. In other words, it was well provided for, cared for, loved. This tree that grew and was magnificent became a shelter for all the birds of the air, and they nested in the boughs. So the cuckoo and the robin and the dove and the hawk nested in its branches. And the beasts of the fields gave birth under its branches, so that the cattle and the sheep and the goats gave birth. And there were little calves running and lambs prancing and kids just bounding all over the place. Now, of course, the birds and the beasts refer to other nations, as verse 6 makes clear. And I'm not sure whether they would have quite pictured it in the same way that Pharaoh did. You know, with Assyria and by comparison Egypt being this big nation that sheltered and cared for these other nations. And kind of them all happy and lovey and dovey about it, kind of nestling in the branches and giving birth to their live animals, as it were, or children, I guess, underneath this tree. I mean, most of them have been brought there by force. They've been exiled and brought into slavery. But here in the mind of Pharaoh, it was majestic in beauty, verse 7. It was a tree to behold. It was a nation to marvel at. Such was its greatness that not even the cedars in the garden of God could rival it. Nor could the pine trees, verse 8, or the plane trees. In fact, no tree in the garden of God could match its beauty. There was no nation that could rival it, not even Israel itself, nor God's first kingdom, Eden. Nothing could so rival the majesticness and the glory and the beauty of Assyria and by comparison, Egypt. And verse 9 reveals who was behind it all. I made it beautiful with abundant branches, the envy of all the trees of Eden in the garden of the Lord. It was me, says the Lord. I was the one who sent the spring waters in abundance. I was the one who made these branches grow long and the boughs to increase. I made it beautiful. I allowed it to become powerful. I allowed it to become a shelter to all these other nations. I allowed it to be this abundant. It didn't just happen. And it's easy, isn't it, to go to the British Museum and you look at the artifacts of these once great empires. And you look and you ponder and the brilliance of its leaders or the fortune of its circumstances. Or it's easy to look at the superpowers of our day, the US, China, and to stand there and marvel at its government and its economy and its corporations. And yet, says the Lord, I made it beautiful. All these nations, these superpowers, they've not come about because of man. They've not come about because they had really great and wise and effective leaders, but because the Lord has made them beautiful. The Lord has allowed them to be powerful. The Lord has enabled them to be a shelter to these nations, to draw these nations in. It's the Lord. It's the Lord who is sovereign over the nations. It's the Lord who raises up the nations. I made it beautiful. The Lord who raises up the nations, but secondly, it's also the Lord who judges the nations, verses 10 to 14. So, the Lord who judges the nations. See, this tree with its magnificence and beauty has grown because of the abundance of water. And as it's grown and it's stood there and it's kind of thought of itself, you know what, I look pretty good as a tree and I'm pretty powerful and magnificent. And it becomes proud. Proud of its height and beauty. See verse 10? Because it towered on high, lifting its top above the thick foliage, and because it was proud of its height. The same Lord who made it beautiful in verse 9 now cast it aside in judgment. See verse 11? I handed it over to the ruler of the nations for him to deal with according to its wickedness. I cast it aside. And the words are spoken against Assyria. Assyria will be judged by the most ruthless of foreign nations, verse 12, Babylon. But just as Egypt so desperately wants to compare itself to the greatness of Assyria, so it will share in the demise of Assyria. And the divine lumberjack, the ruthless nation Babylon in its fetching check shirt, will arrive to cut Assyria down. And in turn, under the Lord, it will cut down Egypt. And this mighty tree that stood so tall, its boughs will fall on the mountain and in all the valley, its branches will lay broken in all the ravines of the land. And all the nations of the earth came out from under its shade and left it, and all the birds of the air settled on the fallen tree. And all the beasts of the field were among its branches. And no longer did the birds nest in it, and the cuckoo and the robin and the dove and the hawk fly away. And no longer do the beasts hide under its branches. The cows and the sheep and the goats disappear. And these birds and these beasts are effectively now stand above it as its equal. And this nation, Assyria, that Pharaoh holds up as a picture of greatness, a picture of a land to behold, a land to marvel at, is in fact not to be admired, but condemned. And in fact becomes a warning to all other majestic trees, a warning about pride, about becoming haughty. You see verse 14? Have a look. Therefore no other trees by the waters are ever to tower proudly on high, lifting their tops above the thick foliage. No other trees so well watered are ever to reach such a height. They're all destined for death, for the earth below, among mortal men, with those who go down to the pit. The nations that the Lord raises up, that will become proud, he'll bring down in judgment. And the sentence for the proud is simple. Death. And these nations, far from symbolizing life and offering shelter to living creatures, will instead become synonymous with death itself. And it will become apparent to all that it is the Lord who is sovereign. It's the Lord who's in charge of the nations. It's the Lord who raises up the nations. It's the Lord who judges the nations. It's the Lord who will consign them to their death because they become proud. In their pride, they neglected God. They failed to see it was Him who had raised them up, that it was Him who had watered their empire. And instead, they began to think in some way they were like God. And so they behaved like God. And they began judging and executing nations as if they were God. And they began to think that they could give life and shelter and protect and provide comfort to other nations as if they were like God. And they became proud as they did so, thinking they were magnificent and beautiful and look what we have done. And in time, God judges such nations. He judges the nations, and God still does the same today. As nations become large and proud and further away from His purposes, He judges them and casts them aside. It's the Lord who raises up. It's the Lord who judges nations. And thirdly, it's the Lord who levels the nations, verses 15 to 18. It's the Lord who levels the nations. You see, the great leveler of life is death. All go to the grave. The banker and the homeless person, the model and the ordinary, they all go down to the grave. And the great leveler, as it were, of the nations is that in the end, they all die. Nothing lasts. And having judged these nations for their pride, they're condemned to the grave. Now, in effect, how can a nation, Assyria, be assigned to the grave or to the Sheol, as it says in the footnotes, the kind of underworld? Well, as a nation, it can't. But what we have here is a picture of the demise of the nations. And again, it's the Lord who oversees their demise, who brings about the great leveller. So, verse 15, on that day it was brought down to the grave. And the next bit that the NIV translates, the verb I covered, is a bit contentious in translation due to its meaning. So it could read, which to me seems to be a little bit of a better fit. It reads this, on that day it was brought down to the grave. Instead of I covered, it can be I shut off the deep springs with mourning for it. I held back the streams and its abundant waters were restrained. Because of it, I clothed Lebanon with gloom and all the trees of the field withered away. And in effect, the Lord cutting off the water, shutting it down, means that these trees begin to wither and begin to die. And in that, they're covered in mourning. Just think of a tree that's dying. It looks all withered and it looks like death, doesn't it? You can sell a tree that is dying and a tree that is alive. And a tree that is dying in that sense is mourning. It's just withering away. And it's withering away because in one sense, the Lord is withholding His blessing. He shut off the water. Just as He allowed the water to raise it up, now He shuts off the water and it begins to die. It begins to go down to the grave in judgment for the pride. These nations that were once majestic, standing as tall trees, now fall. And the fall is deep because these were the trees that were so magnificent that they're described as more beautiful than any trees in the Garden of Eden. Such is the language that we're supposed to see them so high, and now they fall to the very depths of the underworld. And when it happens, the nations tremble, verse 16. They tremble at the din of the majestic cedars collapse, reverberates around the world. And they tremble because they fear the same. They fear the same demise, the same end. And in many ways, they know their demise will come because nothing lasts. And as if to prove it, we discover that in the grave, the great cedar joins many other magnificent trees. See verse 16b, including all the trees of Eden, the choicest and the best of Lebanon, all the trees that were well water. And these trees now find relief and are consoled with the arrival of the great cedar, because now they know that no matter how high and mighty a tree may have been during its earthly existence, in death all are equal. The glorious cedar that evoked jealousy in its early earthly life, verse 9, in the grave has nothing to be envied. All are on the same level. These great nations, Babylon and Egypt and Assyria and Eden, are all the same in death, in demise. In fact, they're so such that the nations that even shelter within these bigger nations also find themselves amongst them in the underworld, verse 17. So Edom and Tyre and Philistia and Ammon, they're all the same. Nothing lasts. Nations come and nations go. And the oracle closes with the camera, as it were, turning once again on Egypt, verse 18. And Ezekiel says, which of the trees of Eden can be compared with you in splendor and majesty? Yet you too will be brought down with the trees of Eden to the earth below. You will lie among the uncircumcised with those killed by the sword. And Ezekiel, as it were, jolts his hearer back to the reality. He's not just been presenting a simple story about Assyria. Pharaoh is the problem. And if Pharaoh perceives himself as the heir of the Assyrians' imperial might, then let him share in their fate and the fate of all other glorious trees, including those of Eden. See, Pharaoh will be consigned a place to lie in Sheol among the uncircumcised. He'll be condemned for his pride, just like the Assyrians and the other so-called mighty nations. See, the Lord raises, the Lord judges, and the Lord levels the nations. Because it's the Lord who is sovereign over the nations. He even consigns to them a place in the grave. Nations come and nations go. But the Lord don't change at all. And the transience of empires is a pattern of history. You have to look at history to see that. You only have to look at the history of our nation to see that. I mean, think back at the beginning of the last century, Britain ruled the seas, ruled Britannia. Its empire spread among the nations. And yet within 50 years, the decline had set in. Other nations were taking its place. Or look at the USSR in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s. Everyone was worried about Russia. Everyone was worried about its nuclear power and the Cold War. But now, it had its day. Look at the US of A and the superpower of today. And already people are predicting its downfall. And why? Because they say it's becoming proud. And they're looking to China to replace. Nothing lasts. Nations come, nations go. All will die. And yet in all of this, the Lord is working out his purposes, his sovereign purposes. And what is his great purpose? Well, according to Ephesians 1:11, it's to bring all things under Christ. To put it another way, to see Christ's kingdom, Christ's empire extended over all. To see the true king rule over all. And his empire will be seen, and it will be the greatest empire, and it will be an empire that never passes away. I wonder whether you noticed how a number of times in Ezekiel 31, Syria and Egypt were compared to Eden. Now, in many ways, that's just to emphasize the beauty and the majesticness and so heighten the fall when it came. But it's also because Eden, in many ways, was God's first empire, God's first kingdom. But what happened? Its rulers became proud, thought themselves greater than God, and the Lord humbled them and judged them, and the kingdom of Eden, as it were, was brought to an end. And Ezekiel 31, verse 14, the warning to the nations about pride has always been true. And so Eden passed away, but in many ways it was the prototype of things that were meant. And therefore, ever since then, there's been a desire within us for such a kingdom. A kingdom where God dwelt, a kingdom where there was to be no death, an eternity. In many ways, these kind of raising up of these kingdoms and other nations are, as it were, echoes and shadows of what we long for. A kingdom that is powerful and will protect us and care for us, that will shelter us in its branches. That kingdom we all in truth desire and hunger after. But all these kingdoms, these nations, they'll die and they'll pass away because they'll become proud, because they're tainted with the same problem Eden had, proud rulers. And what we need is a kingdom that is ruled by a perfect king and a humble king. A king who will protect us and care for us and truly shelter us, even dying for us. A king whose kingdom will be eternal. And that king is Jesus. Have you ever wondered why Jesus didn't just become the king to the Jews, as it were? You know, remember John 6? John 6 says that the crowd, the people, wanted to make him king, and he just kind of slipped away up into the mountains and no one could find him. You know, and the question is, why did he not just kind of come along, kick out the Romans, establish his kind of kingdom for the Jews right there and then, take on the whole Roman Empire and be the king of it? You know, why didn't he, when he was just standing before Pilate, just say, yep, I'm the king and I'm going to kick you all out, I'm going to do it right now? Because ultimately, in part, that kingdom was just too small for this king. This king is the sovereign Lord of the universe. His kingdom would be greater than any previous empire. It'd be greater than the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians and the Romans and the Greeks and the Americans and the Chinese. This king's empire will rule over all, and he will rule forever. The Jews in Ezekiel's time, sitting there in exile, would have heard this oracle and have been disappointed. See, their hope would have been in Egypt. That Egypt as a nation would defeat Babylon and kind of set them free. And here they hear that Egypt will be destroyed by Babylon. See, every time you place your hope in the nations of this world, will always be disappointed. They will never do what we hope. Just think back a couple of years ago, we're all longing for a new government to come in. We're all thinking, hey, do you know what? Labour hasn't really upheld Christian values and Christian things, but do you know what? If the Tories get in, hey, they're going to uphold Christian values and Christian thinking, and they're uphold what we really want. Awkward. And we're disappointed. Because every time you place your hope in the nations of the governments in this world, you will be disappointed. But place your hope in the king, the one whose kingdom is eternal, you'll never be disappointed. See, if your hope for your children or your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren is that they're in his kingdom, that they're part of that kingdom, then whatever happens to the nations they are part of now, as it were, ultimately doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter whether or not they have economic security or peace or free healthcare or a pension. Because nothing lasts apart from Jesus' eternal kingdom. And in Jesus' kingdom, they'll be ultimately safe and they'll be ultimately secure and they'll be part of Jesus' eternal kingdom forever. Because Jesus' kingdom is the only real, true kingdom. Everything else are but mere shadows and echoes that will be covered with sand. Do you know the poem by, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Ozymandias? I met a traveller from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, what yet survive, stamped on those lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remain. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Nothing beside remains. Only Jesus, only his kingdom will remain. Where will you place your trust and hope? In nations and rulers that come and go, or in the one who is sovereign over the nations and over the rulers and over every government, the one who raises up these nations, the one who judges these nations and levels these nations and watches over their demise? Where will you place your hope? What are you looking to for your security and hope?"